when the ranging company disbanded in Zavir, for any assignment was temporary. Its members found their nation involved in a presidential election unlike any other that had ever occurred in the Americas. General Sam Houston, forbidden by the Constitution from serving two terms in a row, had to relinquish the presidency in December 1838. But members of his pro-Houston party, as it was called, were determined to elect as his successor some compliant person who would merely hold the office until Sam could reclaim it. Party choice centered upon a distinguished 50-year-old lawyer from Kentucky, Peter Grayson, who had served the new nation in such crucial posts as Attorney General and as negotiator with the United States government in Washington. Grayson's candidacy delighted Martin Ascott, who, as a fellow lawyer, spoke vigorously in his behalf among the settlers. Houston's opponents saw Grayson as a colorless functionary totally unfitted for high office, an assessment which anti-Houston partisans were not slow to point out. A nincompoop, as bad for Texas as Houston has been. The only man worthy to be our president is Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar, a proven hero, a man of great intellectual brilliance, and a general who'll know how to handle Indians and Mexicans. The campaign had become quite heated, and because of the brilliance and roughhouse vigor with which Houston defended his tenure, his supporters assumed that his man would win. Otto, as in the days when he had not known with whom he wished to live, was confused by the haranguing, and he confided to Betsy Bell, who was not supposed to have any opinion about the choice of who would lead her nation, "Betsy, when I listen to Martin, I'm all for Grayson, because Sam Houston saved this nation and I like his ideas. But when I hear Yancey and those others at the inn, I'm for Lamar. I think he has the right approach to Indians and Mexicans." "What approach?" "Shoot them all. No place in this nation for Indians or Mexicans." It seemed certain in early July that Grayson would win, but on the 9th of July, 1838, the pro-Houston party received a bitter jolt. Because Grayson was so drab, so without charm on the hustings, so miserable a speaker, and so without any reputation for heroics during the great battles of the Revolution, which he had sidestepped by one clever trick after another, the Houston people had thought it prudent to keep him out of the country during the critical days of the campaign. As loudmouth Yancey Quimper shouted, "They're afeard to let us see how dumb he is. They let Sam Houston do his dirty work for him." But even so, Grayson might have won had he not, while hiding out at Bean's Station in Tennessee, fallen into one of the depressions to which he was subject and shot himself through the head. This stroke of bad luck appalled Ascott and his pro-Houston cohorts, and some wanted to thrash Yancey Quimper when the big fellow chortled throughout Sevier County, "God's will, he wants no more of Houston or his cronies." After a few days of sad confusion, the pro-Houston party came forward with a much better candidate than the late Grayson. James Collinsworth, an able lawyer from Tennessee, had served Houston in many capacities, currently as the respected Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. He was a handsome man, a gifted speaker, and an able defender of Houston's policies, for he advocated conciliation with Mexico and peace with the Cherokee. After his first successful speaking engagements, Ascott and his friends agreed, "We got ourselves a better man. Collinsworth will be our new president." The Chief Justice had only two drawbacks. First, he was 32 years old, 3 years shy of the constitutional requirement for president. No one in the Houston camp had bothered to check, and when troublemakers like Quimper bellowed, "Even if he wins, he can't serve," the Houston men replied confidently, "We'll take care of that when we get to it." One enthusiast told Otto, "You see, Collinsworth is already Chief Justice, so when the question comes before him, he can rule in his own favor." Otto felt instinctively that there was something wrong with this strategy, and in quest of enlightenment he consulted Ascott. "In the English-American system," Martin said, "any judge must excuse himself from a case in which his own interests are involved. We call that recusation." He spoke with such clarity and with such obvious devotion to the law that Otto returned night after night to talk with him, and Ascott's little sermons formed Otto's basic attitudes toward law and order. Law is one of the noblest of all human preoccupations, for it establishes agreed-upon rules and states them clearly. It protects you and me from the excesses of the mob. He always spoke to Otto as if the boy were an audience of 50 elders, and this was admirable, since the truths he enunciated were so advanced that they stretched the boy's mind. It was then that Otto developed his conviction that the law ought to defend the weak, erect protective barriers against the mighty, and clarify obscurities and conflicts. As a man who had ridden with the local ranging company and who wanted to ride again, he saw clearly that it would be his obligation to enforce just laws and dispense honest justice, and he vowed to do so. Therefore, he noted a contradiction in what Ascot was saying. "But if Judge Collinsworth is too young, won't Lamar's people throw him out if we do elect him?" Otto asked. And now Ascot revealed to him the other side of the law. One of the beauties of practical law is that it enables men and women to do the things they want to, even if the printed law says otherwise. "What do you mean?" "It's the law's responsibility to find a way." "How?" "To prove that things aren't always quite what they seem." "Could you defend Judge Collinsworth and prove that he has a right to be president, even if he is 3 years shy?" "I think I could find a way." And Otto marveled as the young lawyer began to shift ideas this way and that. "Yes, I'm sure I could come up with a solution." Judge Collinsworth's second impediment was a hilarious one. He was inclined to be drunk 4 days each week, so drunk that he could not even dress himself. And Yancey's unrelenting gang made a great deal of this, but the pro-Houston forces had an ingenious defense. They did not try to deny the charge. Too many citizens had seen Judge Collinsworth stumbling into a tree or falling into a ditch to claim that the anti-Houston forces were defaming him. They did point out, however, that since Texas had prospered rather well under General Houston, who was drunk every morning, it was reasonable to suppose that it would do even better under Collinsworth, who would be drunk all day. As one orator shouted, "You don't want a president who sticks his nose into everything every day," and this argument was so persuasive that it began to look as if the all-day drunk Collinsworth would succeed the half-day drunk Houston. But one day in late July, Judge Collinsworth, while crossing Galveston Bay on a steamer, jumped from the aft end, thus becoming the second opponent of Lamar to escape an election fight by suicide. Yancey Quimper and his associates were now convinced that God was participating in the election, since he obviously wanted Lamar to put into operation his announced platform against Indians and Mexicans, and they ridiculed the pro-Houston party's third nominee, a roustabout boat captain from the eastern shore of Maryland. Robert Wilson did not have a history. He had a dossier which summarized scandalous behavior in at least 7 different states. In Texas, he had been a little of everything: land promoter, gambler, sawmill operator, soldier in the 1835 capture of Béjar, senator. But his behavior in the last-named job was so malodorous that he had to be expelled. Promptly re-elected by a district that wanted to be represented by just this kind of man, he told his supporters, "You have reinstalled me as a great man in spite of myself." He offered himself to the public as Honest Bob Wilson, a man who was always as honest as the circumstances of a particular case and the public conditions of the country at the time allow. Wilson was such a pathetic candidate that even stalwarts like young Otto McNabb could not stomach him, and when the presidential vote was counted, Lamar had 6,995 to Wilson's 252. The Georgia poet was now president by a landslide. And yet his inauguration turned out to be a sorry affair. On the 10th of December, 1838, Mirabeau Lamar was prepared to deliver a ringing inaugural speech outlining his plans for the next 3 years. And supporters like Yancey Quimper were delighted with the rumors that circulated regarding the doughty little man's plans. War against the Indians, war against Mexico, Occupation of Santa Fe. Texas is on the move. It was assumed by the Lamar men that President Houston, whose nominees had fared so badly, both at their own hands and at the public's, would quietly retire from the office which he had occupied with so little distinction. But he astonished them by appearing on the platform in exactly the kind of dress George Washington had worn at his farewell, even to the powdered wig. Then, grasping the lectern with unsteady hands, he delivered a 3-hour blistering defense of his conduct and a warning to his successor not to change policies in midstream. At first, the audience grew impatient, then restive, and finally so rebellious that when the tirade ended, poor Lamar folded his grandiloquent speech and passed it along to an assistant, who read it in a confused monotone. As soon as Lamar assumed the presidency, things began to change in Texas, and fire-eaters like Yancey Quimper felt their day had come. No more of that Houston nonsense. Now we fight. To hear Yancey, one would suppose that the Texians were prepared to march to Santa Fe, Mexico City, and anywhere else that came to mind. They were also ready to fight the Cherokee in the east and the Comanche in the west. In fact, if one listened to Yancey, there had never been as belligerent a young nation as Texas. Lamar himself had more sense. As a poet and a well-read Georgia gentleman, he stated frequently that his first priority was education, and he laid the foundations for the little that Texas was to do in this field, for, as one of his supporters complained, "The Texas Congress is always prepared to pay verbal tribute to education, but never prepared to vote a penny toward its attainment." This was a policy established by General Houston, who was wary of books for the general public, even though he himself treasured the few that had formed his own mind, and who absolutely despised all works of fiction, advising his friends never to bother with them. Texas would for decades speak well of education, but not do much about it. Nevertheless, Lamar kept prodding his people to establish colleges and support free public schools, and many years later, when the state felt it must do something if it wished to maintain its self-respect, it did so in conformance to the ideals promulgated by its poet president. Lamar also advocated homestead legislation that would enable Texians to establish their families on public lands. But his greatest contribution was in the world of the spirit, for he expanded Texians' belief that they were a special people, obligated to pursue a special mission. Standing amid the mud and dust of Houston at the eastern edge of his nation, he could see westward to a new capital in Austin, to powerful future cities like Lubbock and Amarillo, to Santa Fe, which by right belonged to Texas, and beyond to the Pacific Ocean. And when he proposed such a vision as the guiding light of his administration, he received enthusiastic cheers from men like Yancey Quimper, who believed that one day New Mexico, Arizona, and California must fall within the Texas orbit, as well as most of Mexico and what would later become Oklahoma. And Mirabeau Lamar is the man to see that it happens. But once the visionary aspects of his administration had been stated, the little president launched what might be termed the practical obligations: kill Mexicans, expel Indians, and lure New Mexico into the Texas nation. In pursuit of the first goal, Lamar dispatched Captain Garner's ranging company back to the Nueces River, which they crossed on various short expeditions in hopes of catching Benito Garza. They failed, but they did shoot up several groups of Mexicans, and would have gone after more had they not been stopped by a surprising development which forced them to withdraw. 2 messengers from the north rode in to announce that Indians had attacked the Republic. The official messenger was an army officer. His guide was Yancey Quimper, big hat down over his eyes, his voice quivering with rage. "Them damn Cherokee that Sam Houston said he'd pacified." "What are they up to?" Garner asked. "Nacogdoches way. Uprising. People being killed." It was always difficult to ascertain exactly what truth lay behind anything that Quimper said. But when the officer took over, it was clear that an Indian war was underway and that the government wanted all companies to converge on Nacogdoches for a final assault on the difficult Cherokee. With some regret, the Sevier County men started north. As they rode, the messenger explained the source of trouble. An eastern tribe, doesn't belong in Texas, was moved west by the United States government. They argued that they're a nation, too, with the right to make treaties, same as England or Spain. He said that the Cherokee were led by a notorious warrior, Chief Bowles, known with respect as the Bowl. He was 80 years old and carried into battle a sword given him by Sam Houston. It brought him luck, for he had never been vanquished. Now Quimper broke in. When you were away, President Lamar issued a proper policy for handling Indians. Get out of Texas or get killed. The officer laughed. He didn't say it that way. His message to Congress was, eviction or extermination. First, we'll try to evict them. One of Garner's men said, Mexicans and Indians, you can't tell the difference. And this verdict represented the consensus, for Yancey Quimper said loudly, In Texas, they ain't no place for a Cherokee or a Mexican. When the riders reached Victoria, Quimper insisted that he accompany McNabb when the latter rode out to visit with Josefina and Maria. And although Otto took no special notice of this at first, he did later realize that his friend Yancey had a deep interest in the two League and a Labor plots owned by the Mexican women. Campbell leave any children? He asked Maria. And when she said no, he wanted to know how his land was left. And she said firmly, It was always my land. And when he asked, What happens to it when you die? She said forthrightly, I have signed it to my brother Benito. Did Otto's father leave any papers, about the land, that is? It was never his land, it was always my sister's. Then it would become Otto's, wouldn't it? Whenever he wants it, Josefina said with a quiet smile at her son. But he told me that General Houston gave him land, up north, for fighting in the war. He said he did not need my land. When Otto moved aside to speak with his mother, Quimper hectored Maria. Where's your brother now? And she replied honestly, I don't know. He comes, he goes. At which Yancey said, I'll bet he does. Later, Otto asked Maria the same question, and she gave the same answer. He comes, he goes. Tell him to be careful, Otto said. When the company approached Sevier County, a scout rode up with devastating news. War up north has turned full scale, Cherokee on the rampage, and they tell us Benito Garza's with them. This news infuriated Garner. We're down south chasing his ghost while he's up here burning our farms. It was quite clear from what Quimper kept threatening that if Garner's men ever caught Garza, they were going to hang him within the minute. But Otto argued with them. That's only what they say. I know Garza, and he's not messing around with Indians. Nevertheless, Otto decided to stay close to Quimper when parleys with the Cherokee began to forestall precipitate action. But this wise precaution proved unnecessary, because when the troop finally reached Sevier County, Yancey discovered that he had important business that would keep him there. So Captain Garner's men rode north without him. They had barely pitched their tents in Cherokee country when Otto was summoned to a night interrogation by the colonel in command, who asked, Son, have you ever heard of Julian Pedro Miracle? I have not, sir. Do you know that we shot him about a year ago? No, sir. And have you heard that we found some very incriminating papers on him, that he was attempting to incite the Cherokee to join the Mexicans, to drive us Americans out of Texas? I did not hear this, Otto said. Well, did you know the Manuel Flores we also killed some time ago? I did not, sir. Have you heard what papers we found on Flores? I've heard nothing, sir. In the tent, the officer thrust a translation in English of the terribly damaging report that the dead Mexican spy Flores had written just before the start of the Cherokee uprising, and they directed his attention to one paragraph. I have completed plans whereby the Cherokee will launch a major harassment of the Norte Americanos to coincide with the army attack of Mexicano troops under Generals Felisola, Kos, Ureya, and Riparda. At the same time, our trusted revolutionary Benito Garza of Victoria will set the countryside ablaze, and we shall expel all Norte Americanos and regain control of Texas. Otto was shaken, and in the dark silence his mind flashed pictures of the Garza he had known. The bright young fellow, trying to find husbands for his sisters, the gifted teacher of riding. That moment of terrible truth when he had saved Otto's life at Goliad, and the swamp knifings at San Jacinto when Otto had reciprocated. During all the chases south of the Nueces, Otto had hoped that the Mexican government would see the wisdom of letting Texas have the disputed land. Then peace between Mexico and Texas would be possible, ensuring peace between Benito and himself. Now he saw his dream was futile. "I am not surprised," he told the colonel. "Is this Garza a friend of yours?" "My father's brother-in-law. I lived with him for 3 years." The officer in charge of the interrogation breathed deeply. "I'm glad you admitted that, son, because we knew the answer before we asked the question." And to Otto's amazement, an orderly brought into the tent Martin Ascott, who nodded in Otto's direction and smiled in friendly fashion. "They arrested me this afternoon." "You were not arrested," the officer corrected. "You were interrogated." "And I told them, of course McNabb knows Garza. And I told them about the incident in the swamp at San Jacinto when you stopped me from killing him. You see, Otto, they had a letter." "I saw it, the one they captured when they shot, what was his name?" "Flores," the officer said. "Manuel Flores. But that is not the letter Ascott speaks of. Someone who knew you in Xavier County, didn't sign his name, sent a letter," Ascott said, "which charges you with complicity in this affair." The anonymous letter was produced. Its ugly charges were ventilated. And Otto had to deny on the Bible that when he stopped at the Zave Campbell dog run on the return from the Nueces, he had consorted with the renegade Benito Garza. "Why did you save his life at San Jacinto, if you knew at that time that he was an enemy?" Silence. "Well, you knew he'd join Santa Ana, didn't you?" Silence. "You better speak up, son. You're in trouble." Very quietly, Martin Ascott, the young lawyer, counseled his neighbor. "You must tell them what you told me that evening." Standing very straight, the youngest and shortest in the tent, Otto recounted his adventures at Goliad, his surrender, the march out from the Presidio that Sunday morning, the dreadful execution of his father, his fight in the woods with the Mexican swordsman, the cut across his face, the gunfire of the 2 foot soldiers. At the conclusion, he said, "I stand here today only because Benito Garza, under risk to himself, helped me to escape." The silence in the tent was overpowering. Finally, the officer in charge asked, "McNabb, what would you do tomorrow if you encountered Benito Garza on the battlefield? These papers prove he may be there." "I would shoot him," Otto said. Next day, the battle was brief and terrible and heartbreaking. The Cherokee Nation, which had been so pathetically abused by the American Nation, brought 800 braves onto a rolling, wooded plain near the Neches River, where they faced 900 well-mounted, well-armed Texians, led by men skilled in such fighting. The Bull, 80 years old and white-haired, friend of Sam Houston, an honorable negotiator with Spain, with Mexico, with the United States government, and with the emerging nation of Texas, saw through copious tears that any hope of living in peace with these harsh newcomers to his land was vain. Indian and white man could not coexist in Texas, not ever. Dressing on the morning of the 15th of July, 1839, in his finest elkskin robes, and wrapping about his waist the golden sash General Houston had given him as proof of their perpetual friendship, he girded on the silver-handled sword which Houston had also given him, mounted his best horse, and led his men into a battle he knew he could not win. All that day, Texians and Indians blazed away at each other, and at dusk it was clear to General Johnston and Vice President Burnett that if equal pressure was applied on the morrow, total victory must be theirs. That night, the confident Texians slept well, all except Martin Ascott, who had tormenting doubts. Shaking Otto awake, he asked, "Why can't we find some kind of arrangement to let them live off to one side?" And Otto gave the answer he had developed while chasing Mexicans along the Nueces. "Texians and Indians, impossible." "Why?" "Martin," Otto said, like an old campaigner to a raw recruit, "go to sleep. We got work tomorrow." Next day the fighting was brief, concentrated, and brutal. There was a violent chase all the way into another county, where the troops cut the bull off from his braves, shot him from his horse, and shot him again as he lay on the ground, his white hair caked with blood, his silver-handled sword a trophy to be cheered. Without their leader, the Cherokee were lost, and well before noon they surrendered. They asked if they could go back and gather their still unreaped crops, for they had no food. But the victorious Texians said they should just continue north and get the hell out of Texas. So they went, honorable wanderers who had known many homes since the white men began to press down upon them. East Texas would know its Indians no more, save for one minute enclave. Mirabeau Lamar's imperial design suffered humiliating defeats, but also enjoyed significant triumphs, proving that although Texas was no supernation, it was more viable than its economic performance might suggest. The history of his attempt to invade Santa Fe and bring it into the Texas orbit can be told briefly. On the 14th of April, 1840, President Lamar drafts a letter to the people of New Mexico telling them of the glories of Texas and warning them that sooner or later they will have to join up. The letter is ignored by loyal Santa Fe citizens who are Spanish-speaking and happy under Mexican rule. The 19th of June, 1841, Lamar personally, but not governmentally, approves of a convoy of 21 ox wagons with military support and a contingent of 321 eager settlers, which sets out to take over the government of New Mexico. The 5th of August to the 17th of August, same year. The expedition, having no guides who have ever been to Santa Fe, becomes hopelessly lost and sends out horsemen to see if anyone can identify anything. The 12th of September, same year. The would-be conquerors stagger into a remote Mexican settlement and beg for water and help. The 17th of September, 1841. The entire expedition surrenders to Mexican troops without having fired a single shot or having been allowed to peddle their promises to a single resident of Santa Fe. The 1st of October, 1841. Almost all of the Texians are marched to Mexico City and on to the old Fort of Perote in the jungle, where they are thrown into prison. The 6th of April, 1842, most of the Perote prisoners are released, but with bitter memories of their mistreatment. On the other hand, President Lamar's negotiations with powers other than Mexico and the United States progressed handsomely, and in 1839, France signed a treaty recognizing the independence of the new nation, thus assuring Texas of full international standing. England, too, made overtures, and the future looked bright. As for the United States, Lamar perceived it as the enemy and refused either to initiate or to participate in talks leading to annexation. Regarding Mexico, he was generously prepared to offer either war or peace, but he was not prepared for what his neighbor to the south actually did. Its troops marched across the Rio Grande and captured San Antonio, but, fortunately for Lamar, they withdrew of their own volition. So Texas was not an unalloyed success, but the valor of its poet president did encourage it to make certain sensible moves, chief of which was the incredible decision to shift the capital from Houston, on the eastern malarial fringe of the nation, into Austin, at the edge of the salubrious highlands. On the day the governmental party surveyed the site for the new capital, Buffalo scampered down what was to become the main street. The intellectual life of the new nation also flourished, thanks to men like Martin Ascott, who took seriously his duties as Xavier County's corresponding secretary of the Philosophical Society. Otto watched admiringly as his friend spent 6 nights in a row, hunched over the table in the kitchen, drafting by candlelight his first submission to the society. And although Otto could not know it at the time, the resonant success of this paper was to account for an experience from which Otto would profit. Corresponding secretaries were obligated to report on the scientific, agricultural, historical, political, moral, and geographical phenomena of their counties. So Martin chose for his topic the Texas pecan Salvator Mundi, and he wrote with such charm that older members said, "There's a lad to watch." He extolled the pecan as a miracle food, a possible source of oil, a tree with unique capabilities, and God's particular blessing on the new nation, insofar as native foods were concerned. What was remembered best was the way he harmonized scientific knowledge about its cultivation with his personal reaction to it. "If corn is our nation's primary cereal, and the pecan our finest nut, is it not appropriate that the two be blended in some perfect dish? My wife, Betsy Bell, has discovered a way of doing this in a pie which has considerable merit. Using corn flour and bear grease, she bakes a fine crust, into which she pours a cooked mixture of syrup made from the boiled stalk of the corn mixed with the finest ground corn thickening. She sprinkles the top so richly with pecan halves, lightly salted, that nothing else is visible. She then puts everything in a flat iron receptacle with a cover and bakes it for an hour, until all ingredients combine in what I do believe is the most tempting pie in the world." The country's leaders in Houston were so impressed by Martin's report, and their wives so pleased with Betsy Bell's recipe, that President Lamar gave Ascot an assignment which required work in Xavier, travel to the new capital at Austin, and the delivery of papers back to Houston. Martin, who had a case scheduled before Judge Finnessy, completed the work, but turned it over to Otto to deliver at government expense. Otto rode to Austin with Martin's papers, got them signed, and was told that he could take the new stagecoach down to Houston. The firm of Stark and Burgess had been awarded the right to operate a stage between the new capital and the old, and to accomplish this had imported coaches that had seen decades of service in Mississippi and two drivers with almost as much experience in Alabama. Otto would ride to Houston in the Thursday coach, driven by Jay Cornblow, who had a wealth of beard, a brazen voice, and a sulphurous vocabulary. When the 6 passengers were assembled, 4 men, 2 women, Jake instructed everyone where to sit, then glared at Otto and said, "You fetch the pole and rope." "Where are they?" "Damn it to hell, if I have to tell you people everything, like you as babies, we'll never get to Houston." Asking around the office, a one-room shack with a heavy iron safe, Otto found the gear, and when he delivered it, Jake studied him contemptuously and growled, "I was gonna let you work the pole, but you ain't got the weight to give it leverage." It was a scheduled 3-day trip, and before it started, Jake assured his passengers, "If this was July or August, we'd get there in great shape." But it was late March in the rainy season, and when they were only a few miles out of Austin, Otto learned what the rope was for, because they came to a place where a swollen stream had overrun the road, turning it into a Texas quagmire. "All out," Hornblow bellowed. And when everyone was standing beside the mired coach, he threw Otto the rope and told him to take it to the far side of the huge mud hole. But as Otto started to obey, Jake cursed at him as if he were both idiotic and criminal. "God damn it, you stupid horse's ass, you're supposed to tie one end to the coach." So back Otto sloshed, with Jake heaping scorn on him as he bent down to tie the hitch. If you was in the ranging company like they say, the Indians have nothing to worry about. Then, surveying the male passengers as if they were members of a chain gang, he nominated one. "You, take the pole." This stout lever was rested upon a pile of rocks with one end thrust under the rear of the wagon, whereupon Jake yelled at the 2 women passengers, "Yes, you, goddammit, lean on the pole with the gentleman." The other men were expected to go into the mud up to their boot tops and push. In this way, with the horses straining, Otto pulling, the man and the two ladies prizing the rear with their lever, the others in the mud, and Jake cursing God, the rain, the creek, and his lazy companions, the coach worked its way through. The three-day trip took 6 days, with the rope and pole trick being utilized at least 4 times each day. The cost was $15 per passenger, not including food, which was invariably cornbread, greasy bacon, and weak coffee 3 times a day. When the trip ended, Otto and the other men were so outraged by the treatment they had received from Jake Hornblow that they wanted to thrash him, but when they considered his size, they refrained. The high regard in which Lawyer Ascot was held was further demonstrated when President Lamar appointed him to head a commission with important duties in San Antonio. He was to have in his entourage a company of Texas soldiers and Captain Garner with 3 members of his ranging company, now known as Texas Rangers. Ascot suggested that McNabb be one, and the party set forth in the late winter of 1840. As they rode, Commissioner Ascot explained the purpose of the meeting. "At last, the Comanche see the folly of their ways. They want a treaty with us. They propose a wide strip where a truce will be permanently observed, so that maybe now the killings will stop." "What did they say about the white people they hold captive?" Otto inquired. And Ascot said, "If a treaty can be arranged, the Comanche promise to surrender every prisoner they now hold, perhaps as many as 100. This was joyous news, if true, for the idea that savages held white women and children was repellent. Captain Garner offered verification. "I was assured all prisoners would be released. We wouldn't talk otherwise." "What are we expected to do?" Otto asked, and Garner explained, "The Army's in charge. They'll give the orders. My job is to deliver Mr. Ascot to supervise the legal arrangements." "But what do we do?" the 2 other Rangers asked, and Garner snapped, "Obey orders." "Whose orders?" Otto asked, for he did not work well in a confused chain of command. "The Army's orders," Garner said. When they got to San Antonio and saw what a handsome town it was, so much more civilized than their frontier settlements, and with buildings so far superior, they had moments of real delight. The beer was good. The Mexican dishes were new to many of the soldiers. The winter vegetables were a surprising relief from the drab food many of the men had been eating. And there was an air of levity, unknown in the grimmer, less settled parts of Texas. It was as if the men had come into another country, one of ancient charm rather than new rawness. The job of Garner's 3 young men was to stand watchful guard at the courthouse in which the important meetings with the Comanche were to be held, and they were attentive to the plans the Army officer outlined. "Don't frighten them when they ride in tomorrow. Try to accept them as neutrals, and for God's sake, make no move toward your guns. Just let them come at us and pray for the best." When there was a rumble of apprehension, Garner whispered to his men, "If trouble starts, give 'em hell." The Rangers nodded, indicating that they understood. McNabb and his 2 companions staked out a corner of the public plaza where they could stand by next morning as the Comanche Braves rode in with their prisoners. "They say there may be as many as 100 white women and children delivered," Otto told the Rangers. And one asked Captain Garner if he could be detailed to help these unfortunates, who might be in pitiful condition if frontier tales could be believed. But the captain pointed to a small building in which the women of San Antonio would care for the captives. "You stay where you're put," Garner said with unexpected sternness, emphasizing the seriousness of this assignment. That night, an old scout who had prowled the frontiers with Deaf Smith told the young army men who the Comanche were. "They came to Texas late, maybe 1730, not much sooner. Come down across the prairie from Ute country. Mountain Indians moving on to the plains. And why? Because they got theyselves horses, that's why. Yep, when them mountain Comanche got a holt of some good Spanish horses, they went wild. Now they could ride 100 miles for buffalo, 200 to find and burn a Mexican rancho. They took no prisoners, except women and children as slaves. Well, they did keep the 8 or 10 strongest men alive temporary. Me and Deaf Smith had a pact. If and I'm wounded and can't ride and the Comanche is coming at me, you got to shoot me, Deaf. And he said, same with me, Oscar. Well, when they hit Texas about 1730, like I said, they liked to tore this place apart, terrified the other tribes that didn't have horses. You know how the old-timers was scared to the Apache? The Comanche treated the Apache like they was nursing babes. That's how they treated the Apache. These is the savages that now say they want a treaty with us. You know what I think? I think it's all a trap. Tomorrow in that building and out here on this square, something terrible's going to happen. With Comanche, it always does. Apparently, Captain Garner and his army superiors had the same fear, because about midnight Garner told McNabb, "Tomorrow may be touch and go. If at any time I rush out that door waving this handkerchief, I want you three to dash in right past me, guns ready. No Comanche is to escape alive, that is, if they start something." There was great excitement that Thursday morning, the 19th of March, 1840, when from the west the awesome Comanche rode in, for they were ghostly figures from some gruesome fairy tale. Taller than the Cherokee, thinner, with hollow cheeks and deep-set eyes, they wore battle finery that made them seem even more imposing. And by some trick, they kept their horses stepping nervously sideways, as if the animals, too, were aching for a fight. But there was also the gravest disappointment. For when the troop of about 65 neared the entrance to the town, it was obvious that only one captive was being led in, a girl of about 15, whom someone recognized as Matilda Lockhart, captured 2 years before. When people saw her pitiful condition, sobs of the most deep and painful grief welled up, and many had to look away as she rode silently past.